Privacy vulnerabilities.
Yes.
In systems, there are privacy vulnerabilities like manipulation of design, making you sign up or consent to something which you don't want, ads collecting more data, and then introducing or running objects trackers in the background. These are privacy vulnerabilities which are getting introduced in our day-to-day life. And if you're wondering what is a privacy vulnerability, well, privacy vulnerability is a weakness. It's a flaw in application or system that allows unauthorized parties to access, disclose, modify, or destroy private or sensitive information of users. Now, these can be introduced in many ways, but these can create a backdoor entry for risk to your privacy. Now, how do you manage these? How do you address these as a company? And what kind of privacy vulnerabilities are being introduced these days? And what are the hot topics in this context? Well, for all this and more, let's go and talk to none other than Dan Freckling, who is the CEO of Voltiv and going to enlighten us on this topic.
Hello, and welcome to the Fit for Privacy podcast with Punit Bhatia. This is the podcast for those who care about their privacy. Here, your host, Punit Bhatia, has conversations with industry leaders about their perspectives, ideas, and opinions relating to privacy, data protection, and related matters. Be aware that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are not legal advice. Let us get started.
So here we are with Dan Freckling. Dan, welcome to Fit for Privacy podcast.
Great to be here, Punit. Thanks for having me as a guest.
It's a pleasure. So let's start with a simple question. AI is coming, and how would you define AI in one word?
How would I define AI in one? I would probably define one word. Can I use two words? Can I say the first chapter?
Yeah.
I think it's the first, we're in the first chapter right now of a long book. And a lot of stuff happens in the first chapter. So it's not a sleepy chapter, as we can see with generative AI and everything else. But it's just the first chapter, and it's a long, it's going to be an engrossing book, maybe even a series.
That's good. That's good. And how do you define then privacy in one word?
You're going to ask me to do it again. I'm going to give you two words again. I'm going to say inalienable right, because I think that's often forgotten, that privacy is viewed as a privilege when it's really a right.
That's a good one. That's a good one. And when you are working in your life, or in your professional context, do you see any vulnerabilities that are coming around into our privacy?
Well, I definitely do. And my experience is going to be colored by what I do for Voltiv and my cybersecurity experience. But what I see coming around with privacy is an extension of what we've seen in security. I think of security as focusing on the back door, keeping bad guys from intruding. And privacy is this front door that we've left unlocked, and we've invited in dinner guests, and they've invited other guests that we're not even aware of. And they're coming into our house and leaving with things because we've been focused on the back door. We haven't seen it. And now that we do pay attention to it, which we are doing as a company right now, then we realize companies don't even know who they're inviting in and who they're bringing in, and the dangers of front door data breaches, because they're data breaches whether they come from the front door or the back door.
Absolutely. And I think, do you want to name a few vulnerabilities, especially some mm-hmm. things in context of maybe, say, healthcare or any other specific sector?
Yeah, for sure. As a software vendor, we look in three areas. We look at vulnerabilities around consent, really notice and consent, number one. Number two, objects, which is our description for what goes on a website in apps. And then ads is really the third area of vulnerabilities, internet advertising, ad tech vendors, other third parties. And it's, you know, starting with consent. It's this is definitely a front door situation that we've been talking about, that not asking before sharing or selling data, not fulfilling a promise in a privacy policy. That's a big risk because of the way the regulators look at deceptive activity in relation to what is promised in a privacy notice. Not accepting an opt-out through an approved technology is a vulnerability, whether it's GPC or whether it's a cookie banner or whether it's the UMS, the universal opt-out mechanisms. And then, of course, areas like manipulative design is a vulnerability. So that's just around consent and notice. The second area, when you're looking into what we call objects, or sometimes called trackers, that there's vulnerabilities with what's on pages. There's script code on website and apps that gather info about users, that data is then analyzed and cookies are dropped. And this can go through areas like session replay and device fingerprinting. So these are some of the risks and vulnerabilities that are associated with objects. And I've sort of talked about consent and objects so far. We see about a 20% error rate in the notice and consent area. And we see an even higher error rate, 25 to 60% around objects, because it's really, really hard to orchestrate, even to know what digital objects you have, what trackers you have in an SDK on a web page with the scripts you have. Not to mention, there's piggybacking, right? So it's not just the entity that you're doing business with. There's containers inside tags and pixels, and these are containers for other vendors. And those other vendors have almost like a Matryoshka doll effect. If you think of the Russian nesting doll, that there's another one and another one and another one. So these kind of fan out like tree branches. So, and then the third, really around ads, that we see about a 25% error rate. And when I say error rates, I mean data is shared when it's not intended to be shared. This is just growing in ads. Over 90% of digital display on desktop and mobile is sold through an automated auction called real-time bidding. And the bidder with the most personal information wins. So there's this incentive to share data about individuals. So when Dan Freckling visits a website, there's a number of different supply side platforms that are performing data syncs to see who knows more about me, because the more they know, the more they can append to my bid request, and the more likely that an advertiser is going to want to advertise to me if they know more about me. And so this is just the world of internet advertising. It's the world of web pages and apps. And now we're inserting this issue of consent and notice in new laws, and many companies are struggling to keep up with the regulations. There are 13 laws now in the US, FTC enforcement, OCR enforcement. Well, in a moment, I'm sure we'll talk about health. It's even more complicated in healthcare. So what we see.
And now, I think when you say these are actually the real backdoors, the vulnerabilities, people do not knowing, and there's consent, which is basically manipulative design. There are these trackers and there are these ads, and these are invading our privacy. And I think with the advent of emerging technologies, especially AI or the ChatGPT or things like that, this is going to happen more and more, because that AI will work in the back end and will have that manipulative design more, will have those objects and trackers. I mean, trackers are also artificial in the intelligence per se. And then the ads will automatically track you.
Yeah. Yeah, it can all be sped up. That's true, with AI on the back end.
So it will be all sped up. But do you see any hot topics from business perspective, especially what are they talking? Because this is what we are talking as privacy pros, saying these are the backdoors, these are the vulnerabilities. But what are they talking?
Well, I think a lot of it starts with definition. So hot topic for sure is healthcare and health data and what is defined as health data. And many times, data that was considered generic 5 years ago, 3 years ago, even 2 years ago, now can be classified as sensitive, protected health data. That's a big change. When you look at not just HIPAA accountabilities and California CMIA around protection for medical data, which we've grown used to, but now you've got an expansion, not just beyond those companies that are business associates and those that are not in the healthcare traditionally defined space. So you look at FTC rulemaking around the health breach notification rule and how that has led to enforcement actions against companies and redefining, again, kind of back to this idea of what's in websites, what's in apps, wellness data, fitness, diet, sleep, even fertility, all of these things, right, that may not have been strictly health data, now are falling into that. And sharing that information for internet advertising or through objects can be a breach. So that's a real new thing to get your head around. And then the Office of Civil Rights in the US, the federal level there, that collecting information on apps is considered personal health information for HIPAA covered entities. So those are kind of causing a snowball effect of a growing definition of what falls into health data. And then it then comes along My Health, My Data in Washington State, which is where I'm based in Seattle, which even expands beyond the definitions that we've talked about so far, what's considered as health data. And there's a private right of action with that law. So there's more and more risks for companies in trying to figure out what is health data. And then once you know what it is, how do you protect yourself against demand letters from anyone who can find one error wrong? And there's been a rash of pixel lawsuits. So that is, I think, what I would say is one area that's a hot topic. I think another hot topic is children's data. And that's a perennial hot topic because the internet in various ways has been damaging to children. But one is literally the laws in the US are raising the bar on what is a child in the US, right? COPPA was protecting data for people under kids under 13. CCPA raised that bar to 16. COSA, which is being considered in Congress, raises that to 17. And then CADCA, which was ruled, I think, invalid by a California judge, that was raising the age to 18. So there's this progression of what's considered health data, or sorry, what's considered children's data by various states and federal laws. So that's another hot topic. A third one I would say is video, and mostly because of lawsuits and associations of sharing video data as a violation under the VPPA, the Video Privacy Protection Act from the 80s. And that becomes a court interpretation. The lawsuits are trying to categorize prosaic companies as videotape service providers, which is stretching a little bit the definition of the way that law was originally in created. It was created to protect people from what a video rental store might do for you. But the class actions and lawsuits of various kinds are stretching that to mean anybody who's hosting data on a website. So that combination of clever legal theories and the proliferation of pixels and cookies and tags and scripts and beacons that are often ungoverned on websites make video even a hot topic.
But where are we headed with all these laws and everyone defining different age for children, different rules, rather than, in fact, even if you look at consent, it's defined differently in the GDPR and then in some Asian countries, it's very different. So where are we headed and how will we solve that problem?
Yeah, it's heading to proliferation, both in what you just describe, how consent and notice even are defined in various jurisdictions, but then the technical means of enabling that consent. So I kind of think of it as messaging, right? When messaging began, you had email, and then you had text, and then you started to get proliferation like instant messaging and Slack and Teams and more methods of reaching. So there's no single way to message anymore. You got WhatsApp, you have individual apps that enable encrypted messaging. So the channels of messaging proliferated to that the point it becomes very, very hard to manage. The same thing is happening around consent. There once was a way of expressing consent, which was a cookie banner where you'd reject cookies and under GDPR. And that's given way to preference centers and global privacy control. And as I said a moment ago, the UMS, the universal opt-out mechanisms or the opt-out preference signals, there's going to be companies that are going to create their own channels. Consumer Reports has the permission slip, which is they're acting as an agent for consumers to enable opt-outs. More companies are going to do that. So that proliferation combined with the regulatory proliferation means it's going to be a lot more complex to even know the channels that you need to honor when people are wishing to opt out. And that's a technology problem that will take, I believe, technology to fix.
No, that'll certainly take time. But what can companies do in face of these vulnerabilities? Of course, they can buy your product and we'll talk about that later. But what can they do specifically? How can they manage this backdoor entry?
I think it starts with a data assessment combined with a legal assessment and then culminating with a trade-off assessment. There's three kind of series of assessments that need to be done continuously or periodically. The data assessment for people that are more privacy pros might recognize what I'm about to say is contained as part of data protection impact assessments. But first is the who, right? The kind of data that you have, an inventory of data and a knowledge of data flows. Have you mapped out how PI is stored across different databases? Inventory of the places that you are storing, particularly if it's protected health information or other sensitive data, recognizing that data sprawl is bound to happen. There's all kinds of internal databases. Then the data flow, which is the transmission of data through systems throughout the full data lifecycle, understanding that inventory and flow would be a really important first step when I talk about data assessment. And then beyond that, with whom are you sharing outside your enterprise, outside your four walls? That's part of the data assessment too. What kind of content, what kind of browsing data, what kind of other form data gets synced with your partners? And that's, you know, once you get a good sense of the inventory, the data flow, then a legal assessment, right? Taking the vendors that you've discovered in the data flow review I just mentioned, do you have contracts, the proper contracts in place? Are you performing due diligence? And are you staying up to date on the rules that change that apply to what I'm describing? So that all of that is part of the legal review. And probably the real front page of the culmination of that is going to be in your privacy policy, your privacy notice. Is that up to date? Privacy policies need to include a date in the US of when they were most recently updated. And that date can give a good indication if companies are staying current. And then the last step, this trade-off assessment, is you look at the data you have, the inventory, the flows, the legal risks that of that. What is the business value of the data sharing you're doing? The collection, the mechanisms that you're doing, the technologies you're using to collect data, but then also with whom you're sharing that. And is that really required? Must you collect data to achieve your business outcomes? If you must collect certain types of data, do you need to collect all the fields of data? Do you need to collect all the fields of data on every web page or every interaction on your app or only certain aspects? So limiting the entry points at which data is collected, I think is a really important part of the trade-off assessment. Always look for less intrusive methods of gathering information. And also when you do all of this, because it's an ongoing responsibility, ensure you've got approval process. This is where our clients often come to us for help, because in distributed organizations, in global organizations, in organizations that are using outsourced vendors of various types, decisions about what can be added to an app, added to a website, is sometimes far afield. It's distributed. It's not centralized. So having approval processes before new pixels are added to pages or new trackers or tags are added to pages, and having a process around the due diligence that you're going to do, I think all of this fits into what I would call this third step, which is the trade-off assessment.
Makes sense. I think you summarized it really well. And when you say having an approval process, I cannot agree more, because I was working with a client a few months ago and they changed their brand name. They introduced the word AI into it. Mm-hmm. They didn't inform the privacy person. They didn't inform the legal person. Oh. They just changed the brand. It's just a brand change.
Oh, but it's much more.
It's much more. The moment you introduce the notion of AI in your brand name, the way people look at you, the way people perceive your company, the way people will read your privacy notice, the way people will read your terms and conditions would be with a suspicion, with a magnifying glass. And you need to address that. You need to look at how you process your personal data or even normal data in a very, very different way. And you need to be mitigating that from the start. But yes, companies don't pay attention. And of course, you summarize that, do a data assessment, look at where is data transferring, do due diligence and everything. That's perfectly said. Basically, you said comply with GDPR, in a sense.
In a sense, but I love that example of just changing the brand and adding AI opens up a Pandora's box.
Indeed, it does. It does. And so in all this, the privacy vulnerabilities, the actions company must take, and the AI space, where does Baltic fit into?
Yeah, so Boltiv began as a security company, and we found ourselves pulled into privacy because of discovering the front door problem when we had been helping our clients with the back door. And when I talk to other senior privacy leaders, they often say they've made investments, good investments in technologies and processes in their privacy programs, and complying with regulations, but they'll often say they're not sure if everything's working as intended. So it's, to use the cliche from the Cold War, there's a sort of trust but cannot verify situation, and they walk on eggshells because they don't know if a regulator or a demand letter is going to find a vulnerability. And as our data, as I said earlier, it shows there's good reason for that, with 20%, sometimes as high as 60% error rates in data sharing, where you're sharing data with unauthorized parties that you're not aware of. That's why they add our persistent monitoring to their privacy program, just like they have a form of monitoring for cybersecurity. Boltiv is like a pen test for privacy compliance. And it addresses vulnerabilities before they become liabilities. We have patents, six patents around what we do. We sometimes call this secret shoppers for privacy compliance. We visit, we smoke test all your systems, your privacy tech, your ad tech, your martech, your commerce tech. Is everything working as intended? And as part of this, we work not just with enterprises, but often with law firms and consultants. And we even have regulators as clients who use us. And it's a really good synergy because it helps us know how to build better software. And so those are the key aspects, with the three areas, as I said at the beginning. We focus on consent, notice, digital objects, which are those tags and cookies and pixels, and then the advertising ecosystem of third parties. Those are our major areas of coverage.
That's interesting. That's very, very interesting. And that's something that companies need, everybody needs. But do you use AI in all this, any form of artificial intelligence?
Yeah, it's funny that things are always coming back to AI, aren't they? We do. And we applied AI first in our security side of our business. So we have a security response platform, and this protects against evolving forms of malware. And in our world, it's malvertising, and that's a portmanteau that combines the word malicious and advertising together. What does that mean? It means malware redirects Trojans, browser extensions, and several other categories. That's a form of malicious advertising. There's also sensitive categories, not safe for work and such. But we use our machine learning because we can create fingerprints around threats. And that allows us to detect and respond to those threats much faster, because other approaches would take days sometimes to investigate and identify new threats. And our machine learning detects and classifies and blocks the malicious content in minutes. So that is where AI has really paid off for us. A second area is around image recognition. Because we deal so much in advertising and what's going on content-wise on a web page, that we'll uncover sensitive content, for example, again, not safe for work, unsavory content. Right now it's political season, so there's a lot of interest in excluding certain types of political statements. And that image recognition allows us to not just judge the words in an ad, but actually the images that could be offensive to people in different ways. And we convert the images to assets that allow us to search and compare and detect anomalies. We now have an AI search capability where you can describe an ad that you're looking for, and we'll scour the entire internet of programmatic advertising, billions of ads that we see every day, and produce and ads that look like what you're asking for.
Wow, that's interesting. Earlier in the conversation, you mentioned cookies and you're helping with cookie consent, but I like to ask you a different question on cookies. Do you think cookies are needed? Because I don't think the current way the cookies are working, I mean, they're at all working. It's cookie fatigue, it's cookie nuisance. You keep clicking, 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 and then there's a lot of manipulative design which makes you to say yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think two parts to what you said is there manipulative design to get people to reject cookies, for sure. And we see the regulators taking aim at that. But then the cookies as a technology are seeing their final days. Third-party cookies, I should say. First-party cookies will remain. But with Google, with Chrome being a major browser that's following other browsers and deprecating cookies next year, I don't want to say that third-party cookies have completely vanish, because we will see first party cookies take on some of those characteristics. We'll see IP address take on a role as a replacement for cookies. But it's inevitable that the third party cookie world that much of the internet advertising was built on is gone. It's as good as gone. It will be gone for sure by the end of 2024, when Chrome, which is the largest market share, follows Safari, which is the second largest market share, in blocking them. And we'll be talking about something else. There'll be other terms that for identifiers, unique identifiers for people besides cookies.
Sure. I think the landscape would change, but I hope the problem solves itself, because the landscape will change and the problem appears in another format. That won't help anyone.
Yeah, it's true. We have a couple of really strong forces on the internet. One is the force of monetization, and the other is the force of privacy. And there are always going to be companies that need to enable a free internet, right? I mean, this is not just mischief or shenanigans. There's a reason for monetization that allows us to read free content, view free videos. But that force, right, is coming up against the privacy requirements. And so we're going to always see almost like a cat and mouse game with one versus the other, one force versus the other, trying to achieve a balance.
That's true. So in essence of time, if you had one message to pass to anyone, any company listening to this, what would that message be from your side?
Yeah, I think I go back to where we started, that in our quest for protecting ourselves from backdoor intrusions, let's not forget what's going on the front door, because it does harm consumers. There's real harm for consumers when data gets shared, and we're seeing that more and more. It can affect people themselves, the data of their children. But I think the one message I would say is, let's lock that front door. Let's find ways to monitor that front door. Let's put a system, a security system, if you will, on the front door, not just the back door. Because ultimately, yes, part of it has to do with avoiding regulatory fines and class action lawsuits, and there are financial reasons to do the right thing. But from a consumer trust, there are companies that are already distinguishing themselves by going beyond what the standard is and providing greater privacy protections. And I believe that's going to be like seatbelts, commercial seatbelts, right? In the old days, when seatbelts were an option, right, they were chosen by people that cared about their safety and security. And then what happened? It became everybody. The entire world wears seatbelts. The same thing is going to be true for privacy protections. People that are now more privacy forward will be the early adopters, but eventually we are going to recognize the importance of protecting our data. And so to be a company that comes off with the seatbelts first will help companies brand and position their reputation.
That makes sense. And now, based on this conversation, if somebody says, "Oh, Dan, he's a wonderful guy, and I want to contact him, or I want to get to know more about Boltiv," what's the best way to contact you?
Yeah, well, thanks for asking, Punit. The best way to reach the company is boltiv.com, boltive.com. Reaching me, I'm pretty active on LinkedIn, so look me up. Dan Freckling, I think there's only a couple of us with that spelling on LinkedIn. It's kind of an unusual name. But yeah, let's connect on LinkedIn.
Perfect. So with that, I have to say thank you so much, Dan, for your time and inputs. It was wonderful to have you.
Thank you, Pune. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. If you liked the show, feel free to share it with a friend and write a review. If you have already done so, thank you so much. And if you did not like the show, don't bother and forget about it. Take care and stay safe. Fit for Privacy helps you to create a culture of privacy and manage risks by creating, defining, and implementing a privacy strategy that includes delivering scenario-based training for your staff. We also help those who are looking to get certified in CIPPE, CIPM, and CIPT through on-demand courses that help you prepare and practice for certification exam. Want to know more? Visit www.fitforprivacy.com. That's www.fit4privacy.com. If you have questions or suggestions, drop an email at hello@fitforprivacy.com. Until next time, goodbye.